order. We do have a quorum. Representative Munson moves the minutes from March 27, 2018. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from March 27, 2018, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes from March 27, 2018 are adopted. Members, first up today is House File 3284, Representative West. I will move that House File 3284 be referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance. Representative West, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3284 allows the placement of modular homes in manufactured home parks. Modular homes are manufactured homes that are assembled on site piece by piece. This just gives manufactured home parks more flexibility in the options for their residents to live. I have Mark Bruner from he's the executive director of the Minnesota Housing, Manufactured Housing Association, and he is here to answer any questions we may have on the paper.
All right. Mr. Bruner, did you have any additional testimony into that, or are you here for questions?
I'll take questions if there are any.
All right. Are there any questions from members right away on this bill? Oh. Representative Cleveland.
Well, sure, Mr. Chair. Good morning. I think my question would be, what does the bill do? Why are you here? Why should we vote for your bill?
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Mr. Runner.
Certainly. The manufactured home park licensing statute, well, it was written back in the 1950s for manufactured homes. Modular homes didn't even exist at that time. And sort of the difference here is that a manufactured home is built to a federal building code, which is a part of the state building code. Modular homes are built to the state residential code, IRC, just like a site-built home. Both are built in a factory, inspected by the Department of Labor and Industry. One of the things that this will do is allow modular homes, which you have more flexibility in terms of designing the homes, smaller homes, to be placed in a manufactured home park. So we could have perhaps 600-800 square foot home with some unique designs, dormers, that kind of thing. That you wouldn't be able to do with a manufactured home just because they're more structured in terms of their design. So it allows some additional flexibility intended to provide options for consumers and home buyers to keep some of these manufactured home parks more viable. We're the largest source of non-subsidized affordable housing in the state. There are about 900 manufactured home parks, and they are licensed by the Department of Health.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that explanation. So, of course, this is a health committee, and I guess I'm not really sure what the health implications of this are, if there are any. I take it that up until now, well, I see in the bill, we're on 3284, right? Yeah.
Yes.
There's a tax implication of this. I assume that it's going to the tax committee, Mr. Chair?
Representative Liebling, the next stop board is the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I hope that it will go to the tax committee because it does have a tax piece in here about how modular homes will be taxed. So I guess I would just ask the testifier, is there any health implication to this? I mean, I think it's, in my experience, we don't talk enough about manufactured housing in here because manufactured home parks, I mean, I agree, they are a huge source of affordable housing for people. In my experience, they often are allowed to fall into terrible disrepair. I suppose there are definitely health impacts to that. But I'm not sure whether this bill has health impacts. Maybe you could address that.
Mr. Runner.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. To figure that out or to explain it, my guess would be the health impact is that manufactured home parks are licensed by the Department of Health or the local health authority. We worked with the Department of Labor and Industry on the definitions and the language in the bill. So that would, you know, be the nexus, I guess, that they fall into the licensing purview of the department.
Representative Liebling.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just reading this bill and the fact that it's in the Health Committee, just kind of first thought is government gone wild. I mean, why, like Representative Liebling, why would it be in this committee? So I'm just curious for House research, if a home that is constructed on site, not necessarily a single family home dwelling, but a modular home, if you will, in a park, trailer park situation, if that's constructed on site, is that licensed under the Minnesota Department of Health as well? And if not, why not that, and why this?
Ms. Barkvist.
Mr. Chair, perhaps somebody from the Health Department could come and answer that question.
They were hoping you would say that.
There's always someone for something here for their expertise.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Diaz. I'm the Acting Assistant Division Director for the Environmental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. So manufactured home parks, as Mr. Bruner had mentioned earlier, were basically given authority to the Department of Health to license and regulate manufactured home parks back in the 1950s. The statutes have been have not been changed much since the 1950s. Generally, manufactured home parks are only allowed to house or have manufactured homes actually located in the property. There is no authority currently for modular homes or for any homes to be built on site, and the agency does not license or regulate homes that are built on site in any other properties other than a licensed and defined manufactured home park.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Mr. Diaz?
Yes.
Then in the modular home, companies that construct them, do they have to pay a license fee then to the Minnesota Department of Health?
Yep. So the manufactured home parks pay a license fee. They pay a fee per unit that they have installed in the manufactured home park. So based on the size of the park, that's the fee that we assess, and that's an annual license fee for the manufactured home park.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And are you at liberty to tell us what the fee is, if you want to know the cost of that?
So the fee, there's a base, or actually three different base fees based on the number of manufactured homes that are in a park, and that, I believe, ranges from $150 up to about $212. The individual sites themselves, I believe there was actually a fee increase in 2017, so I don't have the new value memorized based on that, but it's generally somewhere in the range of $1 to $4 per site.
Is that a McDonald?
And then I think lastly, do you know what the genesis was in the 1950s as to why this would be created probably by this legislature for modular homes?
Mr. Runner.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. I wasn't around then, but what I've read is that it actually was brought forward by the industry to create some standards and uniformity. So that's the extent of my knowledge.
Representative McDonald.
Very good, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern about this bill is that modular homes are, to my understanding, modular homes are somewhat more of a permanent structure than what a mobile home where they just roll it in and take the wheels off and put it on jacks. I believe modular homes actually don't have a floor to the structure. They're assembled on site with panels that they put together. Is that correct, or is there? Can you give a little more broad definition of the difference between modular homes and mobile homes?
Mr. Runner.
Mr. Chair, same as the other. A manufactured home is built to a federal code or the HUD building code, which is a part of the state building code. Modular homes are built in a plant. Modular homes are also built in a plant. Built to the state residential building code, IRC code. Both are inspected by the Department of Labor and Industry, receive a seal, an inspection seal. And honestly, the only way, in most cases, you can tell the difference is in mentioning the flooring. Manufactured homes are required to retain their floor, a steel frame or a floor, as a part of the design of the home for transporting the home. Modular homes are not, and they essentially remove the frame from under the home after it's been transported. So sort of the fundamental difference between the two, if you were an appraiser or an assessor, you'd crawl under the home and take a look, is there, do you see a steel frame or not, and that'd be a pretty good indicator of whether it's a modular home or a manufactured home.
Representative Munson.
Thank you. I guess my concern is that these spaces at the mobile home parks are all rented, and I know that there's been a lot of articles in the news recently about, as I follow real estate, about developers looking into changing mobile home parks and buying the land and redeveloping it, but there are, when they go to basically not renew the leases of their tenants, the mobile homes are expected to be moved because they're mobile. But because people sometimes, most of the time, will own their mobile home, but because they can't move their home anymore, the mobile homes have become immobile because of their age, that they fight to say, you can't make me move because my mobile home can't be moved. Where in modular homes, because they're somewhat more permanent in the way that they're built, I would see that as an issue where these homes, whether they're renting the land they're on, that they can't be moved. So are we building more permanent structures in these rented spaces, and is that going to cause an issue for development of land later on?
Mr. Runner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Munson, with a modular home and a manufactured home, outside of a manufactured home park, may both be required to have a basement, permanent foundation. So, in either case, a manufactured home or a modular home would, be on a basement if it were private property or in the subdivision. In a manufactured home park, and we worked with the Department of Labor and Industry on this, the home, would be placed on a frost-free foundation, similar to what a manufactured home is. It could be relocated or moved, and actually the next bill that Representative West has will discuss the issue of closure. Actually, our intent here is to try to avoid closures by allowing an option of smaller homes, more unique designs, so that perhaps you can have some upgrading of the housing stock with a better fit for what consumers are looking for today.
Okay. I will.
Munson.
Thank you. I will. I'll follow up with Representative Nolan before the Jobs Committee that I also sit on. So, thank you very much.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rahner, is this to avail people of being able to move these tiny homes in? Is that the intent?
Mr. Rahner.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Well, we wouldn't necessarily call them tiny homes, but it will allow for perhaps a smaller home. I actually have, maybe it would help if I could have a page to just distribute, what we're talking about as far as a...
Thank you, Representative McDonald.
But the... we wouldn't call these tiny homes, but you could have smaller homes. You could have a 500-square-foot modular home with dormers. So the tiny homes, we've been seeing are more of the RVs, not habitable year-round. These would be in compliance with the state residential building code.
Representative Peel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Being we're going to the next bill, I think I'll reserve my other questions for that.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Representative Liebling.
Oh, so I'm glad Mr. Diaz is still there. My question was really for him. But first of all, members, thank you for asking some questions and raising some questions about this. I appreciate it. Sometimes we just let these things go and we don't do our due diligence. So thank you for those questions. Mr. Diaz, I just wanted to ask you about any, since you're here representing the Department of Health, which regulates these parks, what's the department's position on the bill, if there is one? Are there any implications that you see that would be within the jurisdiction of this committee?
Mr. Diaz.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the department doesn't see any issues with this particular bill. Moving a modular home into a manufactured home park would have the same concerns that moving a different-sized manufactured home into a manufactured home park. There are some spacing requirements and other regulations for where these units are placed. You can have single units, double wides when it comes to manufactured homes. You could have modular homes that have an equally large or larger footprint as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So am I correct then in thinking that the only reason that modular homes aren't already included is just because they didn't exist before and it's kind of an update to the statute? Am I kind of characterizing that correctly?
Mr. Diaz.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess this is more of a comment because I feel like some of these homes could accommodate more people with disabilities, and I think that it's great when we can have some other options. These are beautiful-looking homes that are affordable, and so I just want to thank Representative Nolan for the bill.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 3284? Seeing none, are there any other final questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one thing I will add is this doesn't preempt any local ordinance that they don't want modular homes for whatever reason. And it also requires written permission from the park owner, so nobody will be placing a modular home without everyone knowing about it. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your support.
With that, I'll renew my motion on House File 3284. We referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 3284 is referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance. Thank you, Representative West. Next, House File 3285. Representative West, I will move that House File 3285 be referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance. Representative West, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3285 actually is also an initiative of the Governor. Although our bills aren't exactly the same, the primary thing it does is increase the Relocation Trust Fund. Right now that's at $1 million, and it's used to help closing manufactured parts from their relocation costs for the people who have lived there. It almost was wiped out, I believe, this past year based on the number of closings, so the Governor and I both recommend increasing it to $3 million. That should, it hasn't yet bottomed out at $1 million, so $3 million should keep it going for a good long while. I believe why it is in this committee is because it has the Department of Health maintain a master list of all the parks in the state. Currently, we do not have a master list, and there's an issue with that because the trust fund is funded through individual assessments on the individual manufactured housing owners. So I believe that is the only area under this jurisdiction, although Mark Bruner could enlighten us more.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bruner. If you could please again introduce yourself for the tape and present your testimony.
Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association. Yes, Representative West is correct. What this does, at least relative to the Department of Health, is simply create a pathway for the department to share its licensing list with MMB, who's charged with sending out invoices to the owners of manufactured home parks to assess a $12 or $15 fee per home site, which goes into the trust fund, which is used if there is a closure to assist in relocation costs or buying homes that can't be relocated. Thank you.
All right. Are there any questions immediately? Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative West, you mentioned that you and the governor have somewhat different views on this. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We took an amendment in the last committee that brought it nearly in line with the governor's proposal. Minnesota Housing Finance Agency also testified in the last committee saying the differences were not immense.
Thanks,
Mr. Chair. Well, Representative West, I don't think you answered my question. Could you just tell us what are the remaining differences?
Representative West.
I do not know the remaining differences.
Representative.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 3285? Seeing none, we'll go to member questions. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a small question. Does this bill have updates for the modular housing, too, or is this going to be coming back through again if the other one passes?
Mr. Runner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Munson, this, the only application this has to modular homes is if a modular home were to be in a, you know, manufactured home park and the trust fund would apply, then the modular home would be covered. But otherwise, there's no distinction or need to address them separately.
Representative Munson.
Okay. I was just, the reason, just in case the cost of moving a modular home are more expensive than moving a manufactured home, that just to make sure that those homes are also covered. That's what was my clarification. But if it just applies to mobile home parks and all of their tenants, then I guess that would be fine. Thanks.
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the bill, I also list the relocation costs. So the relocation costs are capped.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, probably staff. What was the beginning of this program as to why the taxpayers in Minnesota would subsidize a trust fund for a piece of property that was either purchased by the city through eminent domain or other mechanisms and or a big developer? Why is it the state would subsidize relocation fees, and why isn't that just the impetus on the city and the developer?
Representative West.
Representative McDonald, the state does not subsidize this. This is funded through fees to the actual owners of the housing. So this is entirely each of them pay $15 a year. When it reaches right now $1 million, they no longer have to pay it unless they have to pay out of the trust fund. We're upping it to $3 million. The only difference that will mean is they collect the funds longer until they hit the $3 million cap. Then it stops. So we're not taking taxpayer dollars and subsidizing anything here.
Representative McDonald.
Please note for the record that McDonald was wrong on this issue, and thank you for the clarification. Representative West.
Thank you.
Very rare.
McDonald,
yes,
Representative Sandstedt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Line 4.13 of the bill starts in the section where it says failure to notify. As I read through that, when I get to line 4.14, I'm not understanding what it's saying. It just reads very awkward to me.
All right, who wants to take that one? Mr. Runner.
So Mr. Chair, Representative, what this does is address a situation that we had this past year where the MMB, they had some staff changes and that didn't actually send out their invoices in a timely manner for the collection. There have been a couple of closures that brought the balance way down, and I think in the process of sending out 900 notices, about 300 were returned due to, you know, poor addresses and that kind of thing. There were issues with the owners of the properties being able to collect from their residents because in statute they're required to make it a part of the monthly rent statement. This is essentially saying that if the department doesn't do its job by a certain date, that then we waive the collection for that cycle.
Representative Sunset.
Thank you for the explanation. I'm just wondering if the way this is worded is awkward. I don't know that maybe it's just me, but I don't know if it's clearly stating what you just stated.
Mr. Runner.
We could certainly have to visit with you about some changes
okay.
as it goes forward to the next committee, if that would be helpful.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sunset. Are there any other questions for House File 3285? Seeing none, final word, Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for this robust discussion and appreciate your support.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 3285 be referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 3285 is referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability, Policy and Finance. Thank you, Representative West. Up next, Representative Gunther. House File 4032. I'll move that House File 4032 be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. Representative Gunther, welcome to the committee. Whenever you are ready to your bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. It's a pleasure to be before this committee. One time I think I had paid a part of this committee. Back a long time ago, I had Jobs and Human Services together, and that was quite a treat. I learned a lot. House File 4032 establishes two Greater Minnesota child care facility accounts, one in the general fund and one using bond proceeds. The purpose of the accounts is to expand the number of child care slots in Greater Minnesota, which has lost a lot of them in the last few years. Grants would be awarded up to $500,000 per project, with no community getting more than $2 million in grants for a two-year period. Mr. Chair, the bill calls for $5 million in these funds. However, due to the scarcity of general fund dollars, I would like to remove the request for $5 million in general funds. And if your targets are so generous that you want to bring it back, you certainly have that ability to do that in this bill. And I'll look forward to that. With me today are former Representative Dan Dorman, now works for the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Partnership.
That's it. He used to be a vice chair for somebody, too.
Yeah, he used to be my vice chair.
Thank you for that, Representative Gunther. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dorman. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. My name is Dan Dorman. I'm the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. The Greater Minnesota Partnership has 80 members, over 80 members in Greater Minnesota, and we do advocacy on economic development in Greater Minnesota, which is why we're so interested in this piece of legislation. We believe it's about economic development. The partnership, as I said, has over 80 members. It includes businesses, chambers of commerce, some nonprofits, EDAs, and the like. So it's throughout the state, broad spectrum. And over the last few years, we've been hearing from more and more of our members over what we call the child care conundrum and its impact in is having an economic development in Greater Minnesota. You should have in your packet two handouts I'd like to call your attention to. Ours called the child care conundrum. It's just got some quick facts on it that I think help explain overall our what we're thinking in the child care area, and then a letter of support from our sister organization, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Again, we've heard from our members that this is a important economic development issue. In fact, we did some polling prior to the start of the session with our members, community leaders, other people. Top issue, trained workforce housing was second. Third was the availability and affordability of child care. And really, if you think about it, they're all part of the same issue. Because if you're going to have a successful community, you're going to grow jobs and better jobs. If you fail in one of those three, you're going to have a difficulty in really bringing people up. So and just to give you a highlight of why this is an important issue, over the last 10 years in Greater Minnesota, we're much more dependent on in-home facilities. We've lost over 15,000 child care spots or slots, while at the same time, the metropolitan area, because they have kind of an inverse proportion of child care centers to in-home compared to Greater Minnesota, they've actually added 3,200 spots. And so it's really becoming a, you know, I think it's going to spread to the metropolitan area. I think it's coming, the crunch that we're feeling, but it's for sure hitting Greater Minnesota, particularly smaller communities. This is certainly not the only solution. I mean, there's some funding issues, a lot of other things that could and should be done, but this is one thing that I think is a reasonable first step trying to help to alleviate the child care shortage in Greater Minnesota. That's all I have, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to stand for any questions or cease.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dorman. Representative Gunther, why don't we take your two other testifiers, and then we'll open up for questions.
Very good. Mr. Chairman, we have Holly Sammons from Laverne. You ever hear that place?
I'm quite familiar for the last 32 years.
And Jeff Andrews. And later on, we have a guest from up north that would like to say a few words.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Sammons. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Holly Sammons, and I'm the Economic Development Director for the City of Laverne. Laverne is a town of about 5,000 people in the far southwest corner of the state. We are about 20 miles east of South Dakota and about 15 miles north of Iowa. As my position in the economic development arena for working for the city, I have the opportunity to work with the entrepreneurs in our business community that want to start a business. Typically, they come into my office, they share their dreams with me, and I can connect them with the people and resources to make their dreams come true and start their small business. I've had several entrepreneurs over the past number of years who are interested in starting a daycare center, owning and managing it. They have the education, they have the passion, and they would really like to make this investment in their own hometown. It's great for us to hear because we have exclusive in-home providers in Laverne. So as we go through this business plan development, I connect them with the Small Business Development Center. We work on their business plan. We do some financial modeling. Ultimately, it circles back to the property. Where are you going to do this center? We don't have many existing facilities that are a perfect fit, and so ultimately we always have that discussion on new construction. Where is their property available? How much does it cost? What is the cost of new construction? And it doesn't take long after that that we realize that the numbers involved make it completely unrealistic and nearly impossible to build and start a daycare center. It always ends up being the deal breaker. There's a fundamental gap between what it costs to start and run a daycare center versus the tuition rates that we can charge in our area with the density that the parents can afford. When this happens with any other entrepreneur who wants to, say, start a pizza place, if it doesn't cash flow and it's not going to get financing, it's dead in the water, and we say, come up with a new business plan. However, child care is essential enough that we can't give up on this. But it's very obvious that a business plan cannot support the debt service on a facility. The city and the EDA have spent countless hours trying to figure out what we can do to plug that gap. Perhaps we can acquire property and donate it in kind. We've looked at ways to finance new construction. We've looked at ownership ways to facilitate some type of lease option for an in-home provider, but ultimately nothing has come through. What's really challenging is that this entrepreneur has the lure of jumping across the border into the state of South Dakota to start their daycare operation. Brandon and Sioux Falls are lucrative markets. They have less regulation. Startup costs are much less. The education requirements are less. And they have a higher density of population and people making more wages to pay higher tuition rates. And for some reason, it works. 20 miles away, we have an extreme competition. But we're not willing to give up on this issue because child care is essential to our local economy. I know it as a mother, working mother. I work full-time, and I have three children, so I've been in the daycare world for 10 years. We've bought and sold homes. We've moved. Our kids have started school. I've switched jobs. All of that changed, but one thing that didn't change was my daycare. I can't let my daycare go because I can't find any other daycare. So you need consistent, reliable daycare, and once you find it, you can't let it go because child care is that important in our local economy. As I continue with my economic development leadership groups and our local investor groups and our visioning groups, what we've determined is that child care is often a critical factor for our local businesses. We have businesses that we have a 2% unemployment rate in our community. It is hard to fill your job vacancies. They're advertising. They're getting few applicants. When they finally do get a qualified applicant who's ready, willing, and able to take the job, they make the job offer. The dreaded phone call is 3 days later when they say, I'd really like to take the job, but I can't move there because my wife can't find any child care. So not only is it affecting personal families, husbands and wives, it's also affecting our business community. And I have the privilege of connecting with our business community on a real personal level where I can hear these stories day after day of local businesses
unable to hire workers and fill jobs because of the lack of child care. Perhaps the most compelling example I can share is with a hospital. We have a surgeon that has twins, and she has an in-home provider who had an emergency closure at 5 a.m. The surgeon called the hospital and said, I have a conundrum. I have no child care. We have 4 surgeries scheduled for today. The CEO looked through the schedule of the 4 surgeries scheduled. 2 of the patients were already admitted, going through their IV and antibiotic process. Those patients that were going through colonoscopies had already started their procedure of the cleanse. She called staff to see if they could watch the children in the break room. She called friends of the family. She called aunts and sisters. Whatever she could do to help this surgeon find child care for her 2 twins on the day of this 4 surgeries. Not only did it impact those 4 surgeries and those 4 patients, but those 4 patients have spouses, they have jobs, they've made arrangements, they've taken time off work, they've gone through the physical work of preparing for these surgeries. So not only is it just a great inconvenience to the surgeon, it's to the staff, the patient, their families, and their employers. And then we have to also measure the financial impact of just canceling all of that. What's the financial impact of canceling 4 surgeries for a hospital on a daily basis? And that also affects our reputation. If we have surgeries that are inconsistent because of a child care shortage, that has a ripple effect throughout our business economy. So our local leaders feel passionate about helping solve this problem. We want to help these entrepreneurs who desire to meet this need within our community, but we also need more resources. Child care is an economic development issue, and I kind of parallel it with the housing issue. When we have a demand for housing and it's tied to job growth, there's this fundamental gap that it costs more to construct the housing project than you can theoretically charge and recapture in your rents. So it's an unattractive business model, so the private sector does not fill that need. It's only through grant funding or through subsidies that those housing projects move forward, and that's because it's part of economic development. I see child care as the same way. It is fundamentally more expensive to construct and own and maintain a facility than you can recapture through your average daily income to make it a profitable, growing business model. So without that public financing part, that public contribution, this issue is going to remain unsolved. So I hope that you understand the necessity of child care in our local economies and how the funding would help fill that gap.
Thank you, Ms. Sammons, for your testimony this morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Jeff Andrews, and I'm a business development specialist at First Children's Finance. First Children's Finance is a national nonprofit organization based here in Minnesota, and we help children, families, and communities thrive by increasing the availability, affordability, and quality of early care and education. We work on the business side of child care, ensuring that child care businesses remain stable and sustainable. In October 2013, we established a partnership with the 6 Minnesota Initiative Foundations to launch a rural child care initiative called the Greater Than MN Project. Today, that effort has been renamed to the Rural Child Care Innovation Program, and it continues to provide rural communities an opportunity to address child care shortages through a framework that links child care to local economic development. Child care businesses play 3 distinct and critical roles in the greater Minnesota economy. Child care is its own economic sector with facilities, employees, and links to other industries. In fact, there are over 11,000 child care businesses here in Minnesota. They also provide services that enable parents to work, to previous testimony, and they're an informal part of the educational system that supports the development of children, the next generation of workers. Child care is an economic multiplier. Every dollar spent on child care generates other business activity. A sustainable supply of high-quality child care is a vital part of rural economic development. And the Rural Child Care Innovation Program has 3 different and primary activities. We do initial analysis and data collection around the supply and need of child care in the local economy. As an example, recent work in Austin, Minnesota showed there was a potential need for 810 child care slots to serve existing families. We also provide a facilitated community planning process. The results in a community solution action plan to guide future support and development of the local child care ecosystem. In fact, 19 communities have participated in this process, with a net new result of 533 child care slots. And ultimately, our process focuses on ongoing support of the child care community through engagement with existing local child care businesses around their business practices, as well as support of new business owners beginning a child care business. A large part of my work is spent partnering with rural communities to address child care shortages. This work includes working with individual organizations and communities that are attempting to address the child care shortage with innovative solutions. My most recent experiences working with several startup child care businesses have illustrated that their capital investments have ranged anywhere from $15,000 to $30,000 per new slot of child care. Child care businesses need capital for initial startup expenses as well as to finance expansions and facilities projects. Coupled with razor-thin operating margins in many cases, the capital requirements become daunting and sometimes unmanageable to allow a project to proceed. I can attest that this bill is exactly on target with what greater Minnesota communities need, as it will provide access to funds necessary to make many of these projects come to fruition. House File 4032 provides a desperately needed support solution to enable communities to be a part of a larger solution to the statewide child care shortages. We are fortunate in Minnesota to have a wide spectrum of child care offerings to meet the needs of individual children and families. This includes a great group of family child care providers, child care centers, as well as school-based programs that are doing very important work preparing our youngest citizens. Again, thank you for the opportunity to share this information with you, and if I can be of assistance, please feel free to connect with me.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Andrews, for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have former Representative Lauren Solberg say a few words. He's got a big interest in this also.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Solberg, and welcome back to the state office building.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, welcome. It's a pleasure to be before your committee. It was not a pleasure sitting there sometimes when I had to sit there. But I was,
we understand the feeling, Mr. Solberg.
Well, I thank you for allowing me to just give some support to this idea. My daughter moved back from Louisiana with five children, and a three-year-old, and she started working as a single mother, and all of a sudden a few years ago, Grandpa and Grandma were really looking for child care, and it was a difficult experience for us to find a spot to be able to have the child care. I serve on the Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce Government Relations Council, and you know, every other week we kind of meet with business people around the table, and one of the themes that is always difficult for their businesses to operate, and we've talked about business growth as well, is the availability of child care. It's an economic driver. It's an economic way to be able to not have the type of successful businesses. Business people struggle with, even though they don't have children, they struggle with their employees having availability of child care. And it's really a difficult issue for businesses. So I want to just very briefly give this particular topic a little bit of a boost, if you can. Grand Rapids and Cohasset are trying their best. We have, a shortage of over 500 slots in the area. Cohasset and Grand Rapids are both of the cities are trying their best to say, how can we solve this project or problem? There's a new school bond issue coming up. There's some discussions going on with how can we then, if they are building a new elementary school or remodeling an elementary school, can we possibly have some resources, develop some resources to be able to add on to that school a child care facility that's owned by the communities. Of course, we're looking for types of financial opportunities and support for that. And this is just a great, I think, opportunity to try to have local communities have some resources to be able to solve the child care problem. With that, I appreciate very much the opportunity, and I'll be short and ask any questions if you want.
Thank you, Mr. Solberg. Questions for these series of testifiers, Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Gunther, for bringing this forward. I don't think we need to debate whether or not we have a need for child care in Minnesota. It's absolutely it's prevalent in every small town in rural Minnesota that we don't have enough child care slots. Over the past several weeks, we've had people in this committee come forward and testify, especially home, the in-home daycare providers, about how over-regulated their industry is and how we've seen 1,600 in-home daycare providers close in rural Minnesota because they're over-regulated, because we're asking their children to be fingerprinted and a whole slew of other issues in rule books this thick. We need to do more to deregulate the in-home daycare industry and provide them the resources to open and reopen their daycare providers instead of, while their industry is hurting, we go in and while they're, you know, reeling from the over-regulation, start opening up city-run daycares in towns across the state. It's frustrating to me to see such an enormous growth of government, to see the cities now getting involved with daycare and opening centers. And this $5 million, and you won't hear me say this very often, but it's not enough money to open in-town daycares, because you ask, you know, the projects in here can go from $500,000 per project, but no more than $2 million in 2 years, but we're only allocating $5 million to this fund. So it's basically you're picking two or three towns in Minnesota that are going to get in-town daycares when we have hundreds of towns in rural Minnesota that need daycare slots. So I'm concerned. I think that instead of building new buildings, we should be looking at these small towns that have 1,000 people that have 8 to 10 churches that have commercial kitchens and classrooms already there, allowing churches to open up daycares and, you know, coming up with some kind of rules so they can divide their, you know, separate the church from the daycare liability-wise and allow people to open up daycares in churches in the meantime by providing some relief and regulations on the daycares. But, you know, I'm concerned about the growth in this $5 million. If we're going to really fund city-run daycares, it's going to have to be tens of millions of dollars allocated every year, and then for the staff, and we're going to have city workers and, in, you know, pensions and unions, and it goes downhill from there, in my opinion. But I do thank you for bringing this forward, because we need to figure out solutions, and I hope we can come up with bills that are going to be really help our in-home daycare providers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Munson. Response for Mr. Dorman.
Chair Schumacher, the only thing I would add is what the bill allows, if you think about it, a lot easier with general fund dollars, because you could do more things. There's no question about it. But the availability of general fund dollars, I think, for this is going to be very difficult. So we looked at with Representative Gunther, other ways to fund it. What a community could do, because I don't think you're going to see city-run child care, but what you'll see, if you think of and you watch the bonding bill, it happens all the time. For example, St. Paul, City of St. Paul and the Port Authority and the nightclub business and the Palace Theater, and they did that to take advantage of the bond funds. There's a project in New York Mills where the county is going to own the building and create four pods. The pods will be for individuals wanting to run their own businesses, so it won't even be a center. It will be for, if you will, in-home daycares, not in-home. So there's some innovative ways that communities are responding to this. But in order to meet constitutional requirements of the bonding dollars, it has to run through a local unit of government. So I appreciate the comments. A lot of things we can and should do. This is not the only solution. I think it's just one piece of the puzzle.
Thank you, Mr. Dorman. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is an important discussion. I know my own community is asking how we can help daycares provide the services they need, and a grant helps people get started in a much more economical way. I've got a gal who's got a loan and some challenges with the rules we've talked about earlier, and parents are really appreciative of the daycare, but as Representative Munson pointed out too, we need to do some adjustments on regulation, but this helps them to be safe and make sure our children are safe too. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keogh. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a comment. Thank you, Representative Gunther. I mean, this is a huge problem. I don't think there's any debate about that. Everywhere you go in the state, people are talking about child care. And it hits on so many levels, and I just have to say that this title, The Child Care Conundrum, I just love that. Somebody's sitting around really getting creative, coming up. No, it just captures it perfectly. And so I think we've got to address the issue from many different points of view. There's just no simple solution. I was going to kind of address the issue, but I think it's been addressed about the difference between having a general fund appropriation with the flexibility that would provide versus the bond fund, but we've all been talking about that already. You know, you got to start somewhere. I think it would be really great if we could just do an appropriation and do the grants and have some flexibility and let different communities figure it out, whether it's in a church basement or whatever they need to do to get this to happen. And I just do want to say, another member mentioned, oh, my God, pensions. God forbid anybody should get a pension.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Flanagan.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say thank you to Representative Gunther. I appreciate this bill, and these are the kind of conversations I think that many of us wanted to have on the subcommittee on child care. As we're looking at these solutions, and Representative Dorman, to your point, this is not the only solution, but it's an important step. Additional options like increasing the provider reimbursement rate, looking at co-ops, but I think that this is a really solid first step, and frankly, is long overdue. And you can rest assured that as we're having these conversations, I'm enthusiastic when we talk about economic development and businesses partnering around this issue of child care. We don't have these conversations enough, and we know that family economic security, as well as a healthy and thriving business community, depends on reliable, affordable child care for folks. And I'm happy that we're having this conversation. So thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative Flanagan. Representative Stenstedt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I just want to say thank you to the author of this bill. It's been stated, I don't need to restate it, but this is only the first step. And I think it's a great way to get people into the business, but we have to make sure it's sustainable. And as part of the child care subcommittee, the one thing that we're not doing is moving forward on increasing reimbursement rates. And that is every bit as important as the overregulation that we've heard about. It's not a one-pronged problem. It is a multi-pronged problem. And if we're going to address this problem seriously, we need to get people into the business. We need to be able to keep them there by not over-regulating, but also by paying them far more than what they're making right now, upping the reimbursement rate. So thank you for this work. I hope we can continue to support our child care workers for the great work that they're doing and incentivize people to get back into the business. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Sandstead. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm going to have to dye my hair red so people can tell the difference between the two.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
and Representative Gunther and all the testifiers. I can't tell you how much I appreciate the comments that you made. And Ms. Sammons, I think we have to put you on the road, because I've been saying quite a bit that, and as several of us have, that this is an economic development issue as well as just a child care family issue. It does affect our economic development, and you did a fantastic job of articulating that for us all. In fact, it's like, make a copy of your comments and send it to every one of us, because this is the kind of thing that we need to have to go forward. The overregulation, the fees, everything these folks have to go through to start a daycare is killing the daycare industry. And we have to have more folks stand up and say, we need this in our community, and we need to figure out better ways to do it. And Representative Gunther, thank you again for your bill. Ms. Sammons, you did a wonderful job. Thank you so much, and all of you did. I think it's a new perspective on something we've been talking about, and you folks all did a great job of saying that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. That's a great suggestion, but we're going to keep her in Laverne for as long as we can. Representative Kreisha. All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 4032? Seeing none, any final questions from members? final word, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This does in no way say there's not a need in the metro area for child care, because there is. And your committee has a lot of possibilities. I remember one thing. I could never understand how to work out the formula to determine what the county-based child care rate is. It was, I don't hope it's still not, but it was one of the most convoluted formulas I ever tried to figure out. I think you can change a lot by looking at the regulations, toning them down, making it easier for people to start a daycare business, and you have a great job ahead of you. Biggest industry in my district is AGCO, largest manufacturer of farm implements in the country, in the nation. And they have 1,450 employees. The CEO of that company's second biggest concern, other than getting a workforce, is Rosie the Riveter works there, by the way, is to get daycare. Every time he looks at me, he says, what have you done? I think this is the first step. We need more money, I agree. But I don't know what his targets are going to be, or the targets that Matt is going to have. Somehow, there's a lot of things pulling the funding from your division. But I appreciate your interest, and I hope we can pass this on to capital investment.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. With that, I renew my motion. House File 4032 be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 4032 is referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. Thank you, Representative Gunther. Next up, House File 3893, Representative Anderson. I move House File 3893 be referred to the General Register. Representative Anderson, please give a brief explanation of your bill when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'll be brief out of respect for your time. What this bill does is expand opportunities for consumers to learn more about what their health care costs so they can make informed decisions. We already provide some data in state statute. This would expand it so that when they can get the data within a 10-day time period, so it's timely, so that when they're making these decisions, they get it faster to themselves. It also requires that health care providers also provide data on the facility fees and any other fees that would be associated with the cost for their care. And so that's in a nutshell. We did include in the Commerce Committee some language that Representative Munson has been working on, too, that also requires providers to post data on their top 25 services that they provide. I think that's a good addition to the bill. And so that's all that I have. I do have a potential testifier if necessary, and I just ask for your support.
Okay, with that, Representative Anderson, you want to have your testifiers come forward to introduce themselves, and please keep the testimony to approximately 2 minutes, if at all possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank Representative Anderson for bringing this legislation forward. Minnesota has a higher percentage of health plans out in our market with deductibles than most other states. And those deductibles themselves are higher in Minnesota than they are in most other states. So we believe that this legislation will help to empower Minnesota consumers in making better and informed decisions about their health care. And, you know, at a time when health care costs are rising and plan design is changing, you know, employers are trying more and more to work with their employees to help them be informed consumers, and we believe that this will help them do that. So I want to thank Representative Anderson for her work on this and Representative Munson's amendment to it. We've made it a better, stronger bill, and happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. The next testifier, I believe, is from Minnesota Hospital Association. Would you please come forward and introduce yourself? And
try to keep your testimony within 2 minutes if possible.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I will tell this committee when a bill is really bad for hospitals or really bad for clinics or really bad for the patients that we serve. This is not one of those bills. So I just want you all to know that this is not a bad bill. We will certainly implement this bill and make it work. But I do feel it's important to point out that this bill is really not going to be all that helpful for consumers. There are two key questions that I think need to be asked. Number one, what health care services are people shopping for? And number two, where is the best place to get that information? So what services do people shop for? They generally shop for more expensive services that are planned. So if you want knee replacement surgery, hip replacement surgery, if you're having a baby, and yes, the unpopular colonoscopy, those are the services that people shop for because they're planned. So this bill requires us to post our 25 most common services above $25. So you go into a clinic, most of those are going to be like a blood draw for diabetes. They're going to be sort of standard tests that there may not be that much variation for. So those are the services that we're going to be posting inside of the clinic. Those are not really the services that people shop for. The second question is where's the best place to get that information? So if you are shopping for services, you're more likely to go online and look online, or you're more likely to get that information from your health plan because they can tell you your copays and your deductibles. So I just want people to understand that this is going to require us to put posters up in our clinics that will have these 25 services. Then we're going to have to post that information for Medicare, Medicaid, the average commercial, and what our charge price is. So for my example, an A1C test for diabetes. Then we're going to post what the Medicaid price is and the Medicare price is. That has the potential to really confuse a Medicaid patient if they come into the clinic and they see the posted price that we get paid. Are they going to think that's what they have to pay? Well, it's not what they're going to have to pay. And the same thing for Medicare. So I just want people to understand that this is not a panacea for price transparency. We're going to comply, but I think it has the potential to be confusing for patients. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Krinke. Do you have any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or with concerns of this bill? Please come forward, Mr. Racer, and how do I know you? No. Introduce yourself and try to keep your testimony within 2 minutes, if at all possible.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I have some handouts. I wanted to just some information.
Staff to hand those out.
My name is Dave Racer. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota, House District 67A. I have co-authored, published 18 books on health care, and I'm tired of the subject, but it won't go away. It needs curing. One of the biggest problems is nobody knows the price of services. We've been working on transparency for quite some time, several months. This bill is really, really close to what my hope had been 6 months ago, and I thank Representative Anderson for getting it to this place. The concern isn't so much that people want to know their top 25 and this and that. I wanted people to know the price the day they walked in the clinic. I think the technology is there. It can be done. So that a person can understand the differentials in price, the Medicaid reimbursement rate, the Medicare reimbursement rate, the charge that their insurance company has contracted with the provider, and what the provider charges. That's why I created this handout. When people have information, they can make wise decisions, they can have wise discussions. Healthcare pricing is extremely complicated. But so is food pricing. When you compare the two, they're both complex economic systems. Somehow the food industry's figured out how to reveal all their prices to us so we know how to buy the right food. We've got to get to that place in healthcare. So, Mr. Chair, we say, show us the price.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Racer, for your testimony. Yeah, imagine going to a grocery store and not seeing any prices on any of the products, and then when you get to the cash register. That's about the condition we have with health care right now. With that, members, do we have any questions? I have two people on the two reps on the list. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author, I have a constituent, well, I have constituents that have come to me and they said, well, they're part of the faith-based cooperative, you know, considered insurance, and they go in and pay cash, and then they get, you know, things are taken care of. They were told that there was a cash discount, but the AG tells them they can only offer it once in their lifetime. I could not get any information out of the hospital, and I could not get any response from the AG. And so I'm also concerned that, you know, whatever we do here, there may be other restrictions that have been negotiated by the AG that could interfere with, you know, getting a notified price or agreed upon price. And I don't know if anyone who's in front of us to testify would have that information, but, you know, it sort of bothers me.
Representative Anderson, would you like to respond, or would one of your testifiers?
Mr. Chair, yes, Ms. Krenke can respond to Representative Kwan's question on this.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Minnesota hospitals are nonprofit, so we are regulated by the Attorney General here in Minnesota. All of the hospitals have a signed memorandum of understanding with the Attorney General that if an individual has a salary of less than $125,000 a year, they are allowed to be given our largest volume discount of our commercial payer. So it is a discount that is available to anyone who makes less than $125,000 a year. It's not a one-time. It is supposed to be ongoing. So that's just for clarification of our agreement with the Attorney General. So.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the little bit of information I was able to get is that the AG has separate agreements with some of the hospitals and that there are additional conditions. And it might be nice if staff or someone could get some clarification about what additional layers are out there, because that seems to be outside, you know, statutes. And if we try to fix something, it'd be nice to have the big picture. Thank you.
Maybe staff could do a little bit of research and bring some clarification back to the committee on that. They seem to be agreeable to that. So, okay, now Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to give my opinion as a uninsured person last year and a person this year with a $13,000 deductible. I do care about the small costs when I go into a clinic, and would use this pricing to shop for the providers. I think even office visits are, you know, twice the price just across the street. And without knowing these costs, consumers can't make an informed decision. And this is how we begin to lower health care costs, and then with it the cost of premiums for insurance, especially in rural Minnesota, which is hit so hard with this epidemic of skyrocketing insurance costs. But I think the rest of the questions have been answered. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I don't think that was a question, so we'll go on to the next Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing this bill forward to try to help consumers shop for better prices when they're getting their care. And there's kind of two reasons to do a bill like this. One is to lower the cost of care, and the other one is to help people when they're trying to go through their deductible to try to spend as little of money as they can so they have more money for their family and for other things. Those are kind of the two reasons to do it. And this really is more consumer-friendly and more leaning towards that direction, which is great. One of the things that I've looked at when I've tried to tackle this in the past is both for medicine and for procedures that people actually do shop when you have a high deductible. So how do you do that? You know, most people go online now. If they're trying to get information, that's difficult. For for the providers. But what's really difficult is that if you're a doctor and people want to know how much their procedure costs, that's a very valid question if it's out of pocket and with a deductible. But if Representative Baker, Representative Quam, and I are all in a waiting room and we're all there for the same thing, I might have no insurance. I would pay one price for, think of a common thing that's not embarrassing that you would go there for. I don't know. Colonoscopy. I might pay one cash price. Representative Quam might be on Plan A. Representative Baker might be working for a company that has a self-insured plan on that might be a different price, all negotiated differently. So you say to the doctor, how much does this cost? Why can't you tell me what this costs? You know, I go to the auto mechanic, he can tell me what a brake job costs. You know, you go to school for 50 years and you can't tell me what this colonoscopy costs. And that's very valid. But even within, let's say, with public programs, it might depend on which HMO the public program is managed by. So there might be 19 different prices for the same thing in the same office. So it's super hard to try to get your hands around this. And I think it's got to be to the plans. So I don't care what Representative Quam pays. I do overall be within the cost of the economy of health care. I really am less interested in what Representative Baker pay. I care what I have to pay for my colonoscopy because that's coming out of my checkbook. So I'm really looking for my specific costs, and that's super important. And one of the things that we were looking at is, okay, when you post this, where do you post it so people can actually use it? Well, on the Internet. That sounds easy enough, but try to find something on the Internet if you don't know where it is. So one of the things that we tried to do is, let's look at Minnesota Community Measurement. We dumped a whole bunch of money in that. Let's post them there. Or let's Department of Health, you know, God help you trying to find something buried in that website. So how you post it, where you post it is going to be a big deal. Or is it on the plans? You know, if you're administered through, let's say you're on Minnesota Care or MA through health partners, that they we're going to, you know, maybe we should make them do that and post it so that I can actually see, not in that case, but with a, let's say, a small group, what that would be. So where you put this stuff is really important. And so I think, you know, it takes a shot at it, which is great. But I really think that we got to think long and hard about where we post this stuff, who can see it, and how to make it easy for people to do that. So taking a shot at that, and I appreciate that, but it's a big thing to chew on for moving forward. But the more people that pay more out of pocket, the more they're going to shop, and the narrower the networks, the bigger a deal this is going to be for people. So thanks, Representative Anderson, and thanks, Representative Munson, for taking another shot at it.
I don't believe that was a question. So Representative Anderson.
I'll wait for closing comments.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Members, any other questions? Seeing none. Representative Anderson, final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, you're exactly right. And, you know, when I think about the poster component of this, when you go visit the doctor, that is probably the most time you will ever have in your life, because I have never gone to the doctor and not had to have wait at least 30 minutes, it seems like, either in the lobby area or when they pretend like they're going to see you and they bring you into the office. And I have my son with me today, and every time I take him, we spend time playing I Spy with all the posters that are in the doctor's office, because you have that much time, and you don't want to touch anything because you're thinking of all the germs that are there. So we spend that time. So I think the poster component of it, I'd probably add a kind of a language on here with the website linking to all the other data that we're looking to have on this, too. I think that would be another step forward, just to give consumers the tools that they desperately need to make good choices for their health care. So I just ask for your support, Mr. Chair, and appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Representative Anderson. Being involved in the health care, I think this is a great bill. Just imagine filling up with gas and then going inside to see what the price per gallon is. This sheds some light on what the actual cost is, and hopefully bring competition and even
lower prices. I renew my motion that HF 3893 be referred to the General Register. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and HF 3893 is referred to the General Register. The next bill on the agenda is HF 3454. I move HF 3454 be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Representative Anderson, when you're ready, please give a brief explanation of your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have testifiers with me that are going to get into the nitty-gritty details of the bill. I'll just say that this is an attempt to try and address the foster care system and addressing concerns surrounding child abuse. This is an issue that I think that we need to do more work on. This is a step in the right direction. And then I'm just going to leave it to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and if possible, keep your testimony to approximately 2 minutes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Alstrom. I'm a senior attorney in Hennepin County Administration. I have 40 years' experience in child welfare in Minnesota across a variety of areas. This bill is a Hennepin initiative. As I'm guessing you all know, Hennepin has the same challenges as the state of Minnesota in the child protection area, perhaps times a few geometrical progression because of the size of our system. Hennepin data from 2009 to 2017, a couple data points that you may have heard but are alarming and of interest. We have an increase in child protection reports of 102%. Over that time period, we have an increase of the number of children in foster care over that same time period of 134%. So significant, significant challenges for the system. We also continue to as a system, be challenged with racial disparities, which are very significant, and again, grow at the same rate as the number of reports and the number of children in foster care. Our board has made a significant investment in our system to move to a child well-being model. They spent $3.6 million in 2015. They spent $13 million in 2016. There's been significant increase in staff, doubling in staff of child protection, aimed at decreasing caseloads, but also aimed at improving the quality of services that we're delivering. One of the things that we did was convene a child well-being advisory committee, which is a permanent committee established by the board to provide outside system accountability so that we stay the course on improving how we are serving children and families. So through the journey of spending money and trying to really address our problems, we are aware of the need for reform within the system, as is the legislature. As Representative Anderson said, these are two things that we think may help address some of our issues. First of all, Section 1 of the bill is about background studies for relatives providing child foster care. And the idea here is that we have the background studies for relatives providing child foster care match the same background studies that are required when they adopt children or when they get permanent custody of children. So align those across the system. This is important because placing children with relatives is a priority of the system. We've done a good job in Hennepin County, as have most of the other counties in the state. 59% of our children are placed with relatives. That's significant. Part of the reason, however, we have the growing number of children in foster care, you may say, well, that's because more cases are coming in. That's actually not the case. The case in Hennepin is that we are removing children at the same or slightly lower rate than we were in 2014 and 2015. What is happening is we can't get them out the back end. That's kind of a crude way of putting it, but our children are stuck. Too many of our children are stuck in foster care. And part of the reason is because of the background issues that we have when we study relatives. So we think that aligning them across the system will significantly help us get some of our children into permanency and out of the system. So that's Section 1. It's in two parts. One is Subdivision 1 would change the background provisions permanently, dependent on Subdivision 2, the success of a pilot, which would be conducted in Hennepin and a couple of other counties to see if what we think is the case really is the case, that is, that the background studies for relatives can make a big difference in achieving child safety and permanency. So that's one part. The second part is looking at the Maltreatment of Minors Reporting Act and actually joining up with some work that the Department of Human Services has already begun to look at a child protection safety and risk-based framework, which is research-based and tested in other jurisdictions, and looking at how that would help counties improve the ability to adequately and safely respond to reports of child maltreatment. So plain English, what does that mean? It means that we're looking for a different framework besides the current statutory framework to try to match up how we meet the safety needs of children being reported to child protection with the resources that counties have so that we're deploying them in the right way at the right time for the right child. Some of the things that the statute require don't necessarily make sense. We're looking to join the Department of Human Services work in piloting how to do that work better. So we're hoping between these two things, this is a step forward in reforming our system in a way that will help children and families. The Department of Human Services does have some concerns about this bill. They have expressed those concerns to Hennepin. We've had a couple of meetings. We have the same goals. We're having very, I would say, very positive talks, and I think we're going to be able to agree on what the ultimate language should look like. That's easier when you recognize that you have the same goals. So we're trying to address their concerns. We don't have amendments for you today. We will have those in finance. So this bill addresses two points in the system that need reform, and it's a start to really improve things for kids and families. I should say it's a continuation of a way to improve the system for kids and families.
Well, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Ahlstrom, and for the work that you do. Is there anyone else in the audience who would testify for or with concerns on this bill? Please come forward and introduce yourself and try to keep your testimony, if possible, to 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Joanna Woolman, and I'm the director of the Child Protection Program at Mitchell-Hanlon School of Law, and I'm here in support of this bill this morning, in particular, the first subdivision. Our program represents parents in child protection cases as a part of our work, and I receive hundreds of calls a year from relative foster care providers who cannot get licensed in Minnesota because of the barriers that exist in our statute and with our process. One story I can highlight briefly for you. A few weeks ago, a grandmother called and said that her grandson had been living with her on and off for several years. Kid would go back to mom, come back to grandma. On one time that kid was at mom's house, he was removed in a child protection case. Grandma has a nephew living with her who, as a teenager, had a misdemeanor theft. Grandma is not eligible to be a foster parent for her grandson. This is not good for kids. When we take kids out of homes, it's so traumatic. When we bring them to a relative, it is less traumatic. This bill is a good thing for children in Minnesota, and I would strongly support it. This is not just an urban issue. While it certainly does implicate disparity issues, this is a problem in rural Minnesota, too, where we have a massive shortage of foster care homes. Supporting relatives' ability to get their kids into care as quickly as possible is in the best interest of children in Minnesota. And we know that kids do better in the long term in some of those outcomes that we really care about. High school graduation, having no contact with the criminal justice system when they stay connected with family, this bill helps do that. I would strongly support this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or with concerns about this bill? Seeing none, we'll go to member questions. Representative McDonald.
Yeah, question for the author. I'm just curious how you, my son and your son are about the same age, how did he ever have you put down the phone and read the I Spy on the...
Representative McDonald, it's optional if you want to respond to that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald,
he doesn't have his own phone.
A good mother. Representative McDonald is... Okay. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for bringing this bill forward and the work of Hennepin County and working closely to get this to where it needs to be. This is a huge issue in St. Louis County, too, and time again it gets brought up a lot. And so I appreciate what you're doing, and I would just say conversations with other counties and, I know Hennepin County is already listed in the bill, that it must be included. I would encourage some conversation with St. Louis County, as I think they'd be very interested. Thank you.
Okay, I didn't hear a question in that. Any other member questions? Representative Kreischer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for carrying this bill. I really like this bill for a lot of reasons, but the biggest is that we are seeing counties step up with the grassroots efforts and looking for ways to solve this. I've been involved with the child protection for a while, and we went through the route of helping DHS shore up some of the policies and procedures so that we could have a standard set at the top, but we also were encouraging counties to come up with solutions like this. And Representative Olson, you're absolutely right on. One of the things that I asked early on was that Hennepin reach out to other counties, and they've been doing that. So we would like to see this pilot established. Let's find out what works, and then let's take those successes, because the thing that we need the most in this, and Representative Anderson, I'm so pleased that you're carrying this, is we need successes, and we need to replicate successes and not just hope. So thank you for that.
Okay, I didn't hear a question in there, so any other?
Jeez.
Maybe I'm deaf in one ear, I don't know. But, Representative Levin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I echo that. Thanks, Representative Anderson. This sounds, I don't know tons about this area, but it's the testifier who came up before from the law program, that was really compelling, and we definitely need to do something about this. I am just kind of curious about why the department, what the department's concerns might be with Section 2. And
is the department here to speak to that? Please come forward, introduce yourself, and respond to Representative Liebman's question. Okay. I believe it's Section 2.
My name is Marvin Davis. I work at the Department of Human Services in the Child Safety and Permanency Division.
Welcome to the committee, Marvin.
Representative Liebling, as it relates to the concerns of the department related to Section 2, there is some work that we are currently doing with the Capacity Building Center for States, and this is part of the negotiations that we have been in regarding our Federal Child and Family Services review, where we had to participate in entering a program improvement plan. And so we are already taking a look at how we may be able to accomplish some of the issues that are in Section 2. Ann Alstrom did indicate that, Hennepin County is working with the department to see if we can work to resolve those issues. And so that's what we're really trying to do right now.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that. Thanks for coming down. And I hope that could get – was this going to the floor?
It was going to HHS Finance.
Oh, okay. Well, so there's a little time here, and I sure hope that we can get all this worked out so that we can move forward on this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any other member questions? Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to lift this up, and I don't have a question, Mr. Chair. I'm going to make a comment like my colleagues. But I think this is important, especially as it relates to the Indian Child Welfare Act. As we're talking about, there's already a priority that Native children, that there's preference that they stay with members of their tribe and also with members of their family. So I'm encouraged and I'm hopeful for the results that can come out of this pilot. Thank you.
Okay, any other comments or questions, members?
Nope.
Seeing none. Any final comments, Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair, I just ask for your support. Thank you.
I renew my motion that HF 3454 be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. And HF 3454 is referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. The next bill on the agenda is HF 3627. I move HF 3627 be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Representative Wills, when you're ready, I understand you have an A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment. I move the A1 amendment, Representative Wills, to your amendment when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. And if it's possible, I'd like to do an oral amendment to the amendment. It's fairly simple. It's up to the Chair's discretion. Otherwise, we can address it in HHS Finance as well.
Well, I'll think about it, but I think so. Go ahead.
What we'd like to do on the amendment, page 1, between lines 1.21 and 1.22, insert page 2, line 3, delete must, and insert may. Renumber the lines accordingly.
Staff and members, were you able to locate that change? So would you like to repeat that one more time, Representative Wills?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. So the amendment to the amendment would read, page 1, between lines 1.21 and 1.22, insert page 2, line 3, delete must, and insert may. Renumber the lines accordingly.
Any questions on that, members? Okay. Any other comments to your A1 amendment, Representative Will? Oh. Any questions on the oral amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not on the substance, but I just think the easier way to do this, rather than make an oral amendment to the amendment, would be just to make an oral amendment to the bill. It's all you have to do is change a must to a may.
I would be open to that as well.
So the chair is not sure which direction to go.
Mr. Chair. Otherwise, Mr. Chair, we could address it in HHS Finance.
Okay, we're going to withdraw.
Theoretically, if we were able to adopt all of this, we wouldn't need to go to HHS Finance because it would be costing.
Okay, we're going
to
withdraw the oral at this point and vote on the A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Members, any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The oral the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Wills, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we will address the other language change in HHS Finance.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. For the bill, what we're looking at doing here is doing a report to the legislature on runaway and homeless youth. It's been a while since this was last addressed, about 11 years. So the language of the bill walks through what that legislative report would look like in updating the 2007 report. And today I have Nicole with me to explain some of the work that's being done and why we need this report at this time.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and if at all possible, can you keep your testimony to 2 minutes?
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nicole Mills. I'm the Executive Director of Oasis for Youth. And Oasis for Youth, we serve young people experiencing homelessness and housing instability who are 16 to 24. In the suburbs of Hennepin County, we focus on Bloomington, Richfield, and Edina. I also have 20 years of work history in the homelessness sector, and I'm here to ask your support for House File 3627. I'm also here to thank you on behalf of the countless young people whose lives have been improved because of your investment in the first report in 2007, which led to our Homeless Youth Act. We know as our state leaders, you all are making so many sacrifices, early mornings, late nights, and you're all choosing to be away from your families so the lives of others can be improved. So thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony.
With your continued guidance, we can solve the issue of youth experiencing homelessness in our state. Since our initial report to the state of youth homelessness in 2007, so much has changed. One major thing, in my opinion, is public perception. People are actually starting to believe me when I say that youth are homeless in the suburbs and in our rural communities. When Oasis for Youth started, people thought our founders were crazy. In 2011, we had 70 visits to a drop-in center, and last year we had 2,500. We've been able to grow and sophisticate our service delivery with help from the Homeless Youth Act, which makes up 12% of our budget. We were able to take those dollars and leverage them to create innovative programming, such as our project with Mall of America. At the mall, we provide on-site support services for their young employees, ages 16 to 24, and we help them navigate all the stuff outside of their work life, like how to get to work, where to stay when they leave work, how to get food, things like that, so our young adults are able to show up ready to work. One example for me is Sarah. She is she came to us about 2 years ago, and she's amazing. She connected with our case manager, Jess, and she was couch hopping. She'd be in Burnsville, Bloomington, South Minneapolis, and she'd be showing up to her shifts late, and Sarah's a good employee. So Jess and Sarah were able to talk to her direct supervisor and explain what was going on. So there's some advocacy there for Sarah to help her maintain her job. With Oasis's help and the Homeless Youth Act's help, we've been able to help her get an apartment, so she's in our rental subsidy program. She's been able to stabilize her life, and she's gone from part-time to full-time, and she's advanced several times at the Mall of America. She's in the guest services, so if you ever find yourself lost at the mall, which may or may not happen, she's right there to help. She's got a radiant smile, and she's just an honor to work with. So I want to thank you again for helping us make that program happen, helping to make Oasis for Youth happen, and all the other possibilities for our young people. I'm here to ask for your continued support to help us update the 2007 report, so we're able to find our gaps in services, know what we're doing well, and also to continue innovation so together we can end youth homelessness in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Wills, and thank you for the great work that you do with these homeless youth.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or with concerns about the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions. Representative Helberson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Wills, for working on this. We've partnered on this over the years, and you and I represent suburbs, and we share a school district, and we know that the issue of suburban homelessness for youth is real. I also want to thank the testifier for putting out the challenge that we get to end youth homelessness. I think that that's one of the reasons I wanted to start working on youth homelessness when I got to the legislature. It's nice to have a problem that we can solve, and this report will help us point us in the direction to how we solve the problem. So I think the report is really important. I also just wanted to lift up the fact that in the amendment we did adopt, it takes away the comment on runaway, which I think is really important in terms of modernizing the way we think about youth who are homeless. I think that the runaway term is old. It conjures up images of children choosing homelessness in some way, shape, or form, and we know that's not true. When kids leave home, it's not because they are, you know, wanting to take a raft trip down the Mississippi. It's because they are living in a situation where they're unsafe and are taking their own power to keep themselves safe, and that's a different story than running away. So I just wanted to make that comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Helberson. Any other member questions? Representative Lieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I'm sitting here doing a little technical work on the bill. And because, you know, after our little discussion about the amendment and just looking at it, and first of all, if the author would want, I don't know why we can't just fix the, make a one-word oral amendment, Mr. Chair. So the author had wanted to change on line 2.3 of the bill to change must to may.
Yeah, Representative Lee, we've decided to address that. It has another stop, and the author indicated that she would address that in HHS finance.
Well, Mr. Chair? The reason for the amendment and the reason for the discussion that Representative Liebling is addressing, the must 2MA, is to ensure that the bill would be cost neutral. So that was our effort to work with the department to make sure that it would not be a financial burden to them to do the report. So we would hope that we wouldn't have to go to HHS finance, but that is up to the discretion of the chair.
Representative Deed, do you want to weigh in on this?
Mr. Chair, we'd have to redirect it somewhere else, so let's just send it to finance and we'll deal with it. If we need to send it somewhere else, we can, but let's just continue it where it's going.
Okay.
That's my opinion.
Okay.
Whatever.
Right.
I will accept that direction.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Weedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't quite finished, so I was just, first of all, I think I have absolutely no problem with the bill, and, you know, thank you for bringing it. I think it's a great thing to do. And just, you know, looking at the amendment that was put on here, I might be off. I might be reading something wrong, but on line 1.23 of the amendment, it says, page 2, line 18, delete the first of this is really, really technical, but since we're going to, you know, move it on for technical reasons, I just wanted to flag that and make sure that that's actually what was intended.
Representative Wills, would you like to have staff address that?
Mr. Chair, in the essence of time, I think it would be best for us to address that in HHS finance since we've decided that's where the bill is going.
Representative Liebling?
That's fine. I just wanted to draw your attention. I've seen some other drafting errors today, and if the more eyes on it, the better, and hopefully we get something into law. It's what we intend it to be. So thanks.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Liebling. Any other questions or comments, members? Seeing none, Representative Wills, final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I appreciate the time, and having carried legislation to increase funding for the Homeless Youth Act in the past and working closely on this issue, I think that getting this report back to the legislature will help us to know how those funds are being used and where the gaps are and where we can best target those funds and to reach the goal of ending youth homelessness in Minnesota.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Wills, for bringing this critically important bill forward. With that, I'll renew my motion that HF 3627, as amended, be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevailed. And HF 3627, as amended, is referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. With that, members, we have no further meetings planned at this time, but keep a lookout for upcoming notices. Thank you for your participation in the committee and this past session. We've dealt with a lot of different bills, and we'll see how many of them actually make it to the governor's desk. With that, we will adjourn.